Welcome to Countersign. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is the second series of Countersign. You can catch up on series one wherever you get your podcasts or by visiting countersignisapodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We welcome your feedback. More details at countersignisapodcast.com. Behrouz Bouchani's book, No Friend But the Mountains, is an extraordinary instance of resistance, survival, and courage. It was written on Manus Island, which is located off the northeast coast of Papua New Guinea, where Australia, for many years, ran a prison facility to hold refugees and other forced migrants who arrived in Australia by sea. The book is all the more remarkable because it was created on a mobile phone, one text at a time. Behrouz documents his near-fatal journey by sea, and the book's poetic language and range make it readily comparable to Homer's Odyssey. The book is a composite narrative with fictionalized names and large portions in poetic verse. This makes it very difficult to categorize in terms of genre, but as Behrouz makes apparent, the fundamental thing about this book is that it is a political act in response to the brutality and torture committed by Australia in these offshore prisons, such as in Manus Island and Nauru. The prison on Manus Island was formally closed in October 2017, but many of its detainees continue to remain on Manus Island. Behrouz Bouchani himself was able to leave Papua New Guinea in 2019 to attend a literary festival in New Zealand. Behrouz spoke to me from Christchurch in late May 2021. We discussed the implications of the Australian border mentality for Australians themselves, currently in the context of COVID, but also in terms of the wider international influence and impact of Australia's border regime. Recent legislation introduced in the UK, the Border Control Bill, seeks to emulate Australia's border regime. Australian and now UK and other countries treat those who arrive to seek asylum as in some way unlawful or illegal entrants. This mistaken categorization has enabled governments of different political persuasions to mobilize populations against refugees. But illegality and the crime lies in countries setting up these offshore detention centers and prisons and conducting torture and other inhuman and degrading treatment in the first place. Behrouz's book, No Friend But the Mountains, serves as an extraordinary response, an evidentiary archive and testimony to the brutality as well as the power of resistance, survival and solidarity for those fighting this cruel system. Welcome, Behrouz Bouchani. I'm delighted that you will join me on Countersign and given me this opportunity to speak with you. Your extraordinary book, No Friend But the Mountains, has influenced much critical work in law and in other disciplines. And I'm interested in hearing about how you set about thinking about this work, which you obviously did in extremely harsh circumstances in Manus prison. And people have described the book as an epic, a tragedy, a myth. It is written with a great deal of poetry and with lots of surrealist images. At the same time, you have also said that, in a sense, this book defies genre. It can't be classified as a particular kind of genre. So I'm interested in first finding out how you thought about the book. It would have started in small pieces of writing, which you obviously did on a mobile phone. So I wanted to get a sense of how the book emerged, how the writing emerged.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I think we can look at this book and analyze it in different ways. So some people approach it as a piece of literature or art. Some people put it in the category of biography. Mm-hmm. And some people, for the Kurdish people, they look at it as a part of their history. Mm-hmm. That the resistance history in Kurdistan and the tragedy in the history of Kurds. But my understanding, actually, if I look at it, my understanding is that we should understand this book as in the context of politics. So mm-hmm. I look at it as a political act.
Yes.
So I know that this book happened in the with the literature, the language.
Yes.
But my understanding is that we should approach it in this way, as a political text and as a political act, because we should always remember that the reason I was writing this book, the first and the main reason, was that I challenged the political structure in Australia and culture, and exposed the system in in Manus Island. So my understanding is that. So I look at it in that way. So, but of course, the readers, they are free to have their own perspective.
Yes, I mean, it's an extraordinary act of political resistance, which, as you say, also exposes the system. And you bring a keen eye to how Australia and Australian borders and the violence of the Australian state is there in Manus prison, was there with you in Manus prison. And you refer to this, of course, through the notion of the Kyriakou system. So you bring a political analysis to bear on the prison system. And your book and your writing has been compared to other prison literature. I also wondered about how you think about this analysis of the Kyriakou system now that you have that you're no longer in Manus Island, you're in New Zealand. But of course, the Australian system of detention is influencing immigration systems and how refugees and other forced migrants are dealt with all over the world. So I wondered how your analysis of the Australian border system continues now.
I think, so you mentioned Kyriakou system. Actually, in the original text, I used the Farsi concept, mm-hmm. System Hakam. Mm-hmm. But when the Omid wanted to translate it, he suggested that he used the Kyriakou system, which is a philosophical term.
Yes.
Which borrowed in the feminism theories. So it is same, I think.
Yes.
So, and so the reason I use that concept just to, as a main concept to analyze the system and how this system designed to take, to control people, and yes. designed to take the detainees' identity mm-hmm. and individuality. So that was the main reason. And this concept actually helped me to not only write about that system, that particular system, and about the detainees, mm-hmm. but actually create a way and a space that we expand this concept to other parts of the society in the free world, you know, in the society in Australia, mostly in Australia and in other countries. I mean, in this capitalism system, if yes. we say it, capitalism system. So, I mean, just I use that term to actually explain this, that now in the society, in the free world, that we say free world, there are many systems which are very similar to Manus prison system. But what we claim is that Manus prison system is the original one. So mm-hmm. we should mm-hmm. study Manus prison system. So, and if we look at the Australian detention system, we are facing an industry. So yes. in Australia, a huge industry established on based of keeping people in indefinite detention.
Yes.
So actually our problem, our fight is not against the people. I mean, mm-hmm. a minister or a prime minister or a party. Our mm-hmm. problem is with the this mentality mm-hmm. that keeping the refugees or innocent people in detention actually is normal for them, and they normalize this. You know, that is our problem. Is with the first is with the structure,
yes,
which is an industry, and second is the mentality, and this mentality is very related to the history of colonialism in Australia. And so our problem, I think, the huge problem is with that mentality.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the mentality of the border, and indeed the history of control on immigration and the racial politics of Australia is something that you draw attention to. And I wonder whether you've thought about the mentality of the border also now as it is unfolding in relation to COVID in Australia. You know, Australia has some of the strongest border regimes in the world in response to COVID. And there is a sense that now Australians themselves are prisoners in the continent of Australia, both inside and outside. They can't get back in. There's Australians who can't get back in. You would have heard about the treatment of Indian Australians in particular now, who are not able to return to Australia. And indeed, that there are very, very strong controls of Australians leaving the country.
I think that is a very great point that you mentioned about the Indian mm-hmm. people. So we actually, I think that is that mentality that I'm talking about. Of course, we understand that if a country put like restriction, mm-hmm. but the problem is that they do this when the situation was very, really out of control in America. Mm-hmm. They didn't do like this,
no.
you know.
No.
So they treat India mm-hmm. in a different way, mm-hmm. and that is the. What we are talking about, racism, which is a part of this mentality. And in the history of Australia, for decades, they had this policy called white policy.
White Australia.
Because they just, yeah, white Australia. So, I mean, that is very interesting. But another thing is that if we think about the quarantine, let me tell you a story. I have been in touch with some people, some Australian citizens who wanted to come back to the country, and they were in, so they have to stay in the quarantine. Yes. And they put these people in a hotel, some hotels that really, so already people accepted that, that they should go to the quarantine for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But they put them in some hotels with very unlogic and I said stupid rules, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. some rules that are not necessary. Mm-hmm. For example, they keep them in the room without the window,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't tell them where they are going to take, where they want to take them, mm-hmm. to which hotel.
Yes.
They don't share this information with them, and just they keep them in those hotels. And I'm in touch with I have been in touch with some of those people, and everyone are very angry. And I say, oh, that is Australia. Mm-hmm. So you just experience that system just for 2 weeks.
Yes.
And you are like this. So that system actually is a system that never answer.
Mm-hmm.
They are not they are you cannot force them to be the like accountable. They are not
yes.
accountable. They yes. don't answer, they don't share the detail, they don't, and they used to torture.
Mm-hmm.
These people already accepted to stay in that quarantine. Why do you torture them?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is the main question in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean if we look at the COVID, you know, and the restriction in Australia and the way they are treating people, treating their own citizens. Mm-hmm. And even in one stage, they were thinking about this. That was a huge debate in Australia that they want to send people to Christmas Island. And they did for mm-hmm. a while,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they did for a while. So actually, it seems that in that country, the first thing that they think about it is to just banish people and prison yes. imprison them, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is very interesting. That is a part of the mentality, you mm-hmm. know. So the only answer is that,
yes,
you know, in the Australian context. So we have lots of examples if we talk about COVID and the way Australia control the borders, and also about the border itself as a yes. concept.
Yes.
You know, and how Australia is doing that, and how they are actually representing a policy which really is very injustice and very inhuman.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's absolutely this sense of a popularity. You know, there is a love for this carceral system, that this is the, as you said, this is the answer to a problem that is, you know, understandably a health emergency where you'd expect countries to put special measures in place. But as you say, the fact that Australians rush so quickly to detention as the answer to
yeah,
some
sort
of
the first thing they, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Yes, yeah.
No, the first thing, and it's not only COVID, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's not
mm-hmm.
only COVID. We can look at this in different ways, you know, that whole, you know, if we look at Manus Island and Nauru,
mm-hmm.
the way they treat the refugees there and that policy, how that policy impact on Australian political culture. You know,
mm-hmm.
so because the exactly the same people are running Australia. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the people, the politicians
mm-hmm.
who have been treating the refugees in that way,
mm-hmm.
they are running Australia, so you cannot expect that someone do something in the street in a way and come back at home and, you know, do it in a different way. You know, you are the same person. And that is the same system, same mentality. And there are many examples about that, you know, the way they are actually restricting the media. They want to control the media in Australia because they already started that with Manus Island, with the refugees, because they already established a policy on based of secrecy, you know, and they normalize that. And after a while, they expand that to other part of the society in Australia. And even they arrested some journalists, you know, they raided the ABC office. And they, you know, there are many examples.
And the
like
homes
the,
of journalists way, as well, yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, the way the system was, they were treating the people for bushfire, people who became displaced for bushfire, because of bushfire in Australia. And I mean, there are many stories like this. I don't remember them, but every day I see that in the news, you know, that something happened in Australia that I, as a refugee, already experienced that, you know. And sometimes just I laugh, you know, because that, as that is character system. That is, you know, that remind me of my experience in Manus Island. And I deeply understand that, you know. And sometimes when I look at Australia and read the news or something happened in Australia, I really, and you know, just recently in the parliament with the scandal, you know, that, that some the in the parliament, it was a they raped a woman.
The sexual
and
violence.
We had
the
sexual violence. The secrecy, the way the prime minister was trying to hide this, the way they were treating the media, the way they wanted to silence people, you know, to don't speak out, the way they wanted to silence the victims, you know, it's very similar for so, what I experienced.
Yes, and this is a useful place to sort of return to the book No Friend But the Mountains, because one of the things that you sort of demonstrate in the book, as you say, so it's the writing was a political act, and it provides a political analysis that can be brought back to all of these other instances within Australia. But part of what you do is you also importantly draw on a Kurdish tradition and style and way of using figurative language. So I was conscious of the way in which you move, for example, in the early chapters, in chapter two of the book, where you are in the sea and you move from the sea to the mountains and from the mountains to the sea, and you use this language in a way that is, I think, very unique to the sort of style that you have demonstrated in the book. I wondered if you could say a little bit about how that enables this political analysis, that your use of the language in this way.
I think the language, so my question about the language, I mean, in this context, you know, I have a general approach and perspective towards language in this context. I mean, the language that we use as a marginalized people. So it doesn't matter if you are a refugee or you are a, from LGBTQ community, what is your, you know, the you are a woman, you are an indigenous person, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, the marginalized people, people who are, I have a question and actually perspective general towards this context. I mean, the for representing and writing about marginalized people. So my perspective is that we should create our own language. Mm-hmm. We should create our own concept, because already the system, the power structure has created its own language. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the media always follow that language. So we should create our own language to represent our situation. So that is my general perspective towards the marginalized people. Mm-hmm. And but about the book, you know, I think the language that you were talking about, that sometimes the book become poetic, mm-hmm. which actually that relate to the history of actually to the language itself, you know, Farsi, yes. Arabic, mm-hmm. Kurdish, you know, these languages are poetic language.
Yes.
Languages, and there is a history of huge and very rich poetry, history and tradition in that region.
Yeah.
So in any way that you write, you write, you know, quite poetic. And sometimes you, even if you write in about politics, you know, your language, the way you use the words become like an poetic and even epic, you know. So I mean that is the power of language. So in that part of the book that you mentioned, of course, you know, just I go back, I have a flashback to mm-hmm. Kurdistan, because you know, the thing that about the refugees is that, and migrants, people, that you never get away of your history and background. And that mm-hmm. background actually always chase you and is a part of your identity. Mm-hmm. So the best way to approach that, just to acknowledge it and recognize it and use it as a source of power and yes. creativity.
Yeah, no, it is extraordinarily powerful use of language and the poetic representations that you present in the book. And the other really important quality, and again, it's a sort of political and philosophical strategy, is that you put what people will call nature or the environment or animals, in that they become acting agents in your narrative. So you break down the border between humans and so-called nature, and you draw from also now indigenous knowledges in your work. So I wondered if you could again say a little bit about how you break down these species borders, and indeed the border between the human and landscape.
Yeah, I think I would like to ask people and the listener to actually, if they want and they are happy and are interested, to watch the movie Choka Please Tell Us the Time. Mm-hmm. So the movie that I made with my yes. colleague Arash Kamali Sarvastani before that we released the book. So mm-hmm. the movie actually was released on 2017.
Yeah.
So that movie actually, if you people watch it, they think that how nature is actually is very important in that context, you know, because that is a visual, so people can watch it and see the whole Manus Island is a beautiful island, I mean, mm-hmm. naturally. And so that is very important. If people go and watch it, it is mm-hmm. like a tropical area.
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, I think I focus on the nature as an element. So I was aware of that, and I was using that nature as an element mm-hmm. to actually challenge the prison, you know. Mm-hmm. The violence of the prison. And so in a part of the book, you see that even the main character of the book, he used to jump from the fences mm-hmm. and sometimes go to the beach, you know, so that just to feel freedom. And in other side, you see the animals as a very important, and you know that that connection, I think in the this context, the connection between human being and animals always is important. You know, if you look at the similar books that written in the prisons or in exile, you see that always there are some animals, because that animal actually are really important, because you emotionally, the animals feed you, you know, the in an emotionally way. And recently I published an article which I say that it is the latest article about Manus Island that I published in a website called Newsroom in New Zealand. It's about the dogs in Manus Island and how was the role of the dogs in that kind that circumstances, and how about my connection and relationship with the dogs in Manus Island.
Do you want to say a little bit about that now? What was your relationship with the dogs?
So in the article I explained about the my history of with the dogs, that at the beginning I didn't want to approach the dogs, because there were some dogs around the prison camp, and after a while they came in, so all different communities you know, were taking care of the dogs. And even I talk about the protests that we did inside the prison camp, and the dogs were there, you know, they became a part of the community, you know. And but I still didn't want to, because I knew that when I leave this island, I must leave them too. So I didn't want to actually have some kind of commitment to those dogs. But in the end, when most of the refugees were transferred to America, to USA, and I was, so the dogs became alone and no one was there to really look after them. So they were hungry, so I had to feed some of them, and I became friend with them. So we created a strong friendship, you know, with those dogs. And in the end, one day they came and they said, so the Manus prison camp closed. So they transferred us to Port Moresby, and those dogs remained there. So that is the whole story, you know. But I think it's very important, this kind of thing. And in the movies, again, you see the animals, you know. You see the cat, you hear the choker bird, you know. And I think you see the butterfly, you know, all of these animals, and you know, they are incredible, you know, if we look at them in that context.
I wondered if you wanted to say a little bit about what you're working on now, and what your plans are.
Right now I do my own writing, which is just fiction. So that is my own work, but the work that I and Omid are working on, so that is very important. And actually we put we spend our time, you know, so fiction just sometimes when I if I feel it. But my main work is just working with Omid again. So we have been working on magazine, not a magazine, actually a journal, an academic journal, which is the I, Omid, Janet Galbraith, and Honey. So we are waiting to publish it. We already did it, just we are waiting they print it. This journal, actually we published the works written by the refugees and also indigenous writers, so we link between the indigenous resistance and refugees, yeah, which is I think it's very very really, I really like that work. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's very important. Another one is a play that I and Omid just, we work with some indigenous actors and directors. Mm-hmm. So that play is coming out.
Your work is just extraordinarily inspiring. I've been teaching No Friend But the Mountains to my students, and I know many colleagues at Birkbeck have been doing the same. And we're just so thrilled and excited to hear about the new work that you're doing, and very much look forward to that. So thank you so much for joining me on Countersign and taking the time to do this interview. I wish you all
thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, it was really nice opportunity to share my idea.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.